Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the December edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with Victoria Gill, Richard Van Orden and Matt Wilkinson. I'm Chris Smith. Coming up, the newly discovered fungus that naturally makes diesel, and it could rewrite what the textbooks tell us about where oil came from.
The discovery of this particular fungus could actually challenge the theory of how hydrocarbon fuels formed in the earth. So obviously fossil fuels are thought to have formed over millions of years from dead vegetation, but it could be that fungi or organisms like this one could actually have digested vegetation and produced hydrocarbons a lot more quickly. So we could have younger fossil fuels forming naturally.
Victoria Gill, who will be unveiling the story of mycodiesel very shortly. And on the subject of oils, what crop yields the most? The answer might shock you.
The reason that people are very interested in algae these days is that microalgae, these microscopic photosynthetic microorganisms, produce more oils or lipids per acre than most other terrestrial plants. Soybeans produce about 50 gallons per acre. Algae, with the current state of the technology, we think can maybe produce about 1,200 gallons per acre per year.
That's why some people are saying that algae are the biofuels of the future. And is this the world's smallest pair of scales?
Well, some Spanish researchers this month from the Nanoscience Research Center in Barcelona gave us yet another example of these amazing ultra-sensitive carbon nanotubes that can weigh molecules to a resolution of within 3 gold atoms.
Sterling stuff. And also on the way, of course, is the answer to last month's chemical conundrum.
What is the chemical in wintergreen mints, the US version of Polo mints for our UK listeners, that creates a faint green fluorescent glow as you chew them?
So if you sent in a suggestion, you could be one of this month's winners. The answer's on the way.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
You've heard the phrase fruits of the forest, but this discovery, Victoria, really is extraordinary because scientists have uncovered a fungal fruit of the forest that makes diesel.
Indeed, this is fruits of the Patagonian rainforest. So Gary Strobel and his team from Montana State University have found a fungus that converts cellulose directly into diesel, or a diesel-like compound. And cellulose is the most abundant organic molecule on Earth, so this could be potentially mean big news for biofuel production.
Why would a fungus want to make diesel anyway?
To feed itself. Cellulose is particularly abundant in plant material, so a fungus that lives in the rainforest would want to break down cellulose into food constituents for itself, and this fungus just so happens to break that cellulose down directly into a mixture of hydrocarbons that it is a fuel. They've named it mycodiesel, but it's essentially biodiesel.
And presumably what, you would have some kind of reaction vessel where you would have this fungus growing and feed it cellulose and it would churn out diesel and related products?
That's not a very practical solution. Having a fungus, it's a rather large vessel for the molecular machinery that actually churns out the mixture of hydrocarbons that you want. So the real key to applying this research is to get the genes, the molecular machinery that do the work that you want, and transfer them into another host, a smaller host, say a bacterium. You could then upscale that in some sort of reaction vessel and make biodiesel directly.
Is it a complicated biosynthetic pathway that involves lots of steps, or is it just a few genes and therefore pretty easy to get bacteria to do for them?
They don't quite know yet. In fact, there's a bit of a family link in here. Apparently, Gary Strobel's son, who is chair of molecular biophysics and biochemistry at Yale, is actually working on isolating the series of genes that carry out this process. So they're going to try and take those genes out and do exactly that, find out what they are and isolate them and put them into a different vehicle.
Have they actually got any success stories yet in terms of just feeding this fungus various types of biomass to see what it can work on? Or is it just going to be wood chips and that's it?
Apart from the fact that they've fed this fungus in the lab on an agar plate and it makes this mixture of hydrocarbons, which is great news. No, they've not taken it any further than that. But the interesting postscript to this research is that the discovery of this particular fungus could actually challenge the theory of how hydrocarbon fuels formed in the earth. So obviously fossil fuels are thought to have formed over millions of years from dead vegetation, but it could be that fungi or microorganisms like this one could actually have digested vegetation and produced hydrocarbons a lot more quickly. So we could have younger fossil fuels forming naturally.
Fascinating. I wonder if we'll actually get to the bottom of that one. Thanks, Vic. And once you've made your biodiesel and burned it and made lots of CO2, you then got another problem on your hands, which is the accelerating greenhouse effect. Matt, you may have a solution, though.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's not me that's got a solution, but it could well be Peter Kellerman of Columbia University in the US, who's used a clever carbon dating technique, the same sort of technique that's used to date mummies and various other artefacts, to study how quickly certain types of rock absorb carbon dioxide. And they found that a certain type of rock can absorb CO2 much quicker than ever previously thought.
Where is this mineral, and how do you think it could be used for things like carbon sequestration then?
Well, the mineral is found in various places around the world, mostly underground, it has to be said. There's a whole bed of this rock that's actually exposed to the atmosphere in Oman, where the research was done. Based on his calculations, Kellerman believes that this rock could absorb up to 4 billion tonnes of CO2 per cubic kilometre.
That's a lot, isn't it? So how does that relate to how much CO2 we produce in a year?
Well, currently we produce about 30 billion tonnes of CO2 a year. So it's a sizable chunk.
It's a realistic ballpark to think that this could be a strategy. How does he propose that we could exploit this mineral to lock away CO2, though?
Well, this is where it all gets a little bit speculative and somewhat more interesting. He has two approaches that might be used, and we also maybe need to put this into perspective that currently most people that are thinking about doing this, and there's lots of companies involved in trying to do carbon dioxide sequestration, are actually trying to mine the rocks and get them out of the ground and then do this kind of reaction at the power plant. Kellerman believes that what you could actually do is pump the CO2 to the rocks, even if they're underground.
Does this mean then that you've got to get all the CO2 out of the waste gases of power plants and then get that to the minerals in order to absorb it? Because that sounds terrifically energy hungry and resource hungry.
That was his first suggestion. However, he's come up with an even cleverer idea. It won't be quite as effective because this reaction is actually produces heat. It really wants to happen. And by increasing the heat of the rock, the rate of absorption increases as well. So by pumping in water that's absorbed CO2 from the air down into deep beds of this rock, that hopefully are near the mantle and relatively warm already, you could actually imagine pumping CO2-laden water that's just absorbed CO2 from the air straight into the rock and letting the reaction go as is.
What is actually the chemical reaction that is taking place that's locking away the CO2, and what is the end result?
It's not exactly a clear-cut single reaction. What's happening is that a series of silicate rocks that make up the peridotite are actually being converted into a series of different carbonate rocks.
So a rock-solid way to combat climate change, you could say. Thank you, Matt. Another way to cut down greenhouse gas emissions is to better exploit the chemistry of the natural world. And a surprising new kid on the biological block that can help us to do this is algae. And to find out how, Meera Senthilingam spoke to Al Darzins.
The reason that people are very interested in algae these days is that microalgae, these microscopic photosynthetic microorganisms, which should not be confused with macroalgae, which are kind of like the seaweeds, have the potential of producing very high lipid or oil contents, potentially up to, you know, maybe 60% of their dry cell weight. They also have very rapid growth rates, maybe one doubling per day. They also can produce more lipids, or again, oil, I'll use that synonymously, oils or lipids, per acre than most other terrestrial plants. For example, a crop that we grow quite a bit of in here in the United States is soybeans, which produce about 50 gallons per acre. Algae, with the current state of the technology, we think can maybe produce about 1,200 gallons per acre per year, with a potential of maybe in the future producing as much as 5 to 6,000 gallons per acre per year. So you can see that is 100 times more than soybean.
Well, a factor making this a particularly green technology over other biofuels out there is the fact that the algae can apparently be fed on the waste carbon dioxide from current power plants. Is this really possible?
Yes, that is absolutely true. In fact, these algae need very few nutrients. So they need, obviously, CO2. They need some nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, and then, of course, sunlight. So they have the capacity of using the CO2 that is perhaps present in flue gases in either a coal-fired or natural gas-fired power plants. And so they can take quite a bit of that CO2 out of the flue gases and use it for their own growth.
But how realistic will it be to incorporate this into existing power plants?
I mean, it's already been shown that organisms can actually grow with flue gases. And what I point to as an example is a colleague of mine in Israel, Ami Ben Amatz, is currently working with a company called Symbiotic. And they have raceway growth ponds associated with the Israeli electric company. So basically, they take their flue gas and they use the CO2, bubble it through their ponds, and actually grow algae all year long. So in fact, to some degree, it's already been done.
But can the algae actually be grown sustainably?
Well, the main issue in order to have it grow sustainably is access, first of all, to large amounts of water. The likelihood is that you're not going to use fresh water in the future. You're probably going to use something like a saline or brackish water, maybe ocean water, depends on what the availability is. You're also going to be growing this on non-arable land. And so, again, I make the point in the United States, there are large tracts in the desert southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, maybe around the Gulf Coast as well, where, they don't grow, perhaps, a lot of corn and soybean and those sorts of things. And these areas, because of the large amount of sunlight that they get, could be excellent places to grow algae.
But the problem with previous biofuels is that they've not been very cost-effective. Is algae going to be cost-effective?
Not yet. We can grow algae large scale. We can harvest the algae. We can extract the oil out of the algae. We can even convert the oil into a very decent diesel fuel or a green gasoline or perhaps even a jet fuel. Can we do this all integrated into one component cost-effectively yet? No, we can't.
So is this the main challenge to be overcome, or are there other challenges involved as well?
No, there is actually quite a number of challenges in each one of the areas that I talked about. So, for instance, there's still a huge debate over which cultivation system is actually the best to use. There are some people who think that these large open raceway ponds are the way to go. Maybe they're the cheapest. There are other people who are actually promoting these closed photobioreactors. These tend to be a little bit more expensive, so there's still a huge debate on which way to grow these algae. Two other areas are how do you remove all the water from the algae? They'll attain concentrations of maybe a few grams per liter of water. You have to remove all that water, harvest the algae before you can actually extract the oil. And then we really don't have cost-effective ways of extraction of those oils at this point in time. So there are many areas both on the biology and on the engineering side that we still have to figure out and make much more cost-effective.
So it sounds like there's still a lot to be done. When are we likely to see this actually entering the fuel market?
That's a very good question. There are some companies who are growing their algae in a very unique way, not photosynthetically, not with sunlight or CO2, but actually in the dark with sugars. And this one company, Solazyme, has probably been the only company to date that has made any significant amount of oil that people can now start looking at evaluating the conversion to oil. But that's certainly not on a commercial scale yet. It's been our estimation that it still may be about 5 to 7 years before we see commercial production of these oils. Maybe full-scale, full-tilt commercial production will have to wait until about 10 years.
That's quite a wait. So when it does come into action, what sort of yields will it produce?
In the future, we think that there's going to be a very interesting mix of a variety of different fuels. I don't think there's going to be one clear winner. I think that algal oils converted to a variety of biofuels will be one. But if we can devote large amounts of land to growing these algae, it's not inconceivable that we could maybe displace 10 to 20% of our petroleum diesel usage.
Al Darzin's talking to Meera Senthilingam. He's a group manager at the US's Renewable Energy Lab. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, how science is helping to make better whiskey in Scotland and how caterpillars are using chemical warfare to fend off ant attacks. But first, Richard, the world of weighing has taken a big step forward on the nano scale. Boom. Tell us about this.
Well, some Spanish researchers this month from the Nanoscience Research Centre in Barcelona gave us yet another example of these amazing ultra-sensitive carbon nanotubes that can weigh molecules to minuscule resolution. So these guys, led by Adrian Bachtold, created a device that could weigh proteins to a resolution of within 3 gold atoms.
How does it work?
Well, this protein weighing machine is a nanotube, and it's pinned between 2 electrodes in a vacuum, and the nanotube is a resonator that vibrates like a guitar string at a frequency, and when an atom hits it, it changes its frequency of vibration, and by relating that to mass, you can weigh very tiny particles. Now, the question is this ever going to replace a mass spectrometer, which is the usual way we use to measure mass by fragmenting molecules up and sending them flying through a tube and balancing electric and magnetic fields to work out how heavy they are? And the exciting thing is, these guys say, is that in the future, these tiny nanotubes will improve on mass spectrometers. They're not quite there yet. So we decided to ask them and other groups how this might work. What they say is it could be possible to make devices that could discriminate between isotopes of the same element, could follow reactions of single proteins. So you could put a hemoglobin molecule on a nanotube and look over time at how it, say, releases oxygen atoms as it reacts, which is pretty incredible. Now, mass spectrometers at the moment, they can get down to the resolution of a hydrogen atom. But as molecules get bigger and bigger, when you talk about the size of proteins, they just don't have that resolution. So really, these nanotubes are offering something that mass spectrometers can't give you.
Now, the principle is reasonably straightforward. You vibrate something, and when you add weight to it, the vibration changes. But how do you actually measure the vibration in the first place? How are they doing that?
Well, it's often done optically. You can do it with a laser beam. And you shine the laser beam in, and you can see how that changes as it comes out, and that you can relate that to vibration. And that's normally the way it's done. In fact, one team, California Berkeley team led by Kenneth Jensen, they've made a vibrating cantilever that can get down to 0.25 gold atom. And theirs also works at room temperature, so we're talking tiny resolutions here.
If we can already do this with a mass spectrometer, why do we want to do it with anything different?
Well, the advantages nanotubes might offer are, well, first, sensitivity. Mass spectrometers are very sensitive, but as you get to really large molecules, that little difference of an oxygen atom being lost, it gets harder to detect. Secondly, we've got the size and the weight. A nanotube is very light, and an array of them would still be minuscule, very light, should be easy to carry around when put in a device. And though mass spectrometers are getting handheld, they're not going to be able to compete with that. And the really exciting thing about being able to determine between different isotopes, determine how proteins are reacting, follow chemical reactions just by real-time mass detection as molecules land on nanotubes that are around. That's pretty exciting, and that's where this research is headed.
It's exciting, and we can see all kinds of potential for that if you can shrink them down that small, because, of course, it makes them very portable, and then you can do things like bioterror detection and other things like environmental monitoring. Thanks, Richard. Now to a way in which your experiments could be thrown into disarray. Matt, tell us about this.
Yes, a team of Canadian researchers led by Andrew Holt at the University of Alberta have shown how chemicals leaching from plasticware can actually affect the reactions that you do in them dramatically.
So what were they doing? How did they find this?
Well, they were initially studying how an enzyme linked to Parkinson's disease reacted with ammonium chloride. And surprisingly, they found that it didn't seem to matter how much they diluted the ammonium chloride, the effects were still there.
So something was amiss. How did they track down what it was?
What they did was that they started off by seeing if they could extract anything from the containers themselves. And they found that there were 2 chemicals in particular that came out of the polypropylene containers while they were doing these reactions that seemed to inhibit the enzyme. One of these is the disinfectant DHEMDA, which is used to stop anything growing in the containers while they're in storage. And the other is the lubricant oleamide that's used to stop the packages from sticking together during the manufacturing process.
So where were these chemicals coming from? Were they actually in the plastic
itself? They're actually in the plastic themselves.
And do we know how they were interfering with the chemical reaction that the researchers were trying to investigate?
They've actually found that both of these chemicals are inhibitors of the enzyme itself.
This is obviously a bit of a canary in the cage. It's saying there are things in these plastic containers that could affect other reactions. Do they speculate as to how else this could throw a spanner in your scientific works?
Well, yes, it kind of throws a spanner into any reaction that you're doing that's incredibly sensitive. If you're using any kind of plasticware, from a container through to a pipette, any plastic has the potential to leach some of its constituent chemicals out of it. The most interesting thing I think about this is, of course, that people have started using disposable plasticware to avoid the problems of incomplete cleaning of glassware.
So is this the death knell for laboratory plasticware then?
No, absolutely not. I think that it really emphasises the need to run control experiments, as we all should do anyway. And you need to seriously control the plasticware that you do use so that you can actually make sure that conditions are kept exactly the same.
So maybe it's not always true that bad workmen blame their tools. Thank you for that, Matt. And now to a big question that whisky drinkers are grappling with everywhere. Should you add water or swallow the stuff neat? John Piggott.
It all depends on your personal preference, really. That some whiskies can be very nice if they're drunk straight from the bottle at bottle strength or even sometimes at barrel strength. But they need to be generally very well matured, very old whiskies. You take cognac, for example, at bottle strength. But for general drinking, then you're probably better to take a cheaper whiskey with some water in it. Because the process of adding the water then obviously dilutes the alcohol. And so it changes the relative concentrations of the flavor compounds in the headspace. And so it changes the sensation you get.
What are the main flavours or determinants of the taste experience when you do drink a fine whisky?
It's very difficult to say because there are so many volatile flavour compounds in whisky. Hundreds, maybe over 1,000 in some products. The major compounds that develop as a whisky is matured are derived from the wood, so that you get a mixture of the compounds from the fermentation, from the original material, the malt, from the changes during the distillation, and the wood materials then add another layer on top of that, so you get a very complex mixture.
And when you take the whisky into your mouth, what actually happens to those compounds?
When you taste a whisky, then obviously it warms up in the mouth. It's diluted a little bit by the saliva, which would inevitably be present. And so the volatility of some of the flavour compounds changes, so that as it's diluted, then some of the compounds more soluble in alcohol will tend to be released. The compounds more soluble in water will tend to stay in the solution, so that the amount of water present, the amount of saliva, changes the relative volatility of the flavour compounds. But if it's a well-matured whisky, then it seems from some of our results that it's more stable, that the dilution, the drinking, the change in temperature doesn't seem to have as much effect.
It sounds like you do fascinating work, which is terribly fun at the same time. Or do you not get to actually drink the whisky yourself?
Well, when we're doing the experiments in the lab, then most of the time it's nosing only. So we do have a whisky tasting machine, which will do some of the work for us, but I certainly enjoy a drink when I'm not at work.
So how do you chemically analyse whiskies? I mean, how do you go about using those machines to become a surrogate human?
I mean, one device, the Strathclyde simulated mouth, it's just a benchtop instrument which tries to simulate what happens when you taste a whisky. And so the volatiles are then collected and the volatiles are taken into a gas chromatograph and they're analysed and identified.
And is the idea of this that you can produce a computer system, some kind of model, that can tell you what is a good whisky without having to rely on the subjective opinion of a human?
In theory, I suppose you could do that, but that would be a long way into the future. We simply don't know enough about the mechanisms of flavour release and the mechanisms of sensation in the taster. It's not as subjective as you might think, that the laboratory taste panels that we use and the experts in the industry are very, very objective about the sensations, that they're telling you what the sensations are, not whether they like them or not, though obviously there is a lot of individual variation that people sense different things.
So is the plan then to use this technology in order to make better whisky?
In the long term, yes, it will help the industry to control the product and to produce more reliable whisky so that formulas can be blended to the flavours that the consumers want.
One assumes that when you make whisky you get a good outcome pretty much every time. How much goes down the drain?
Very little goes down the drain except by accident, but during the whisky maturation process a lot of the alcohol is lost. But in Scotland, for example, if a fairly cold, wet climate, then the alcohol evaporates through the barrels, and so the the alcohol strength of a whiskey during maturation slowly goes down, so that if you keep a whiskey for too long, you end up with a very, very watery product.
Right, so there are economic and alcoholic reasons for wanting to work out what the best blend is as soon as possible, so that you don't have to mature it for so long.
Yeah, certainly. There are some reactions during the maturation process that seem to need a very long time. These would be characteristic of some very old cognacs, for example. But certainly, for economic reasons, for both the companies and the consumers, it's obviously beneficial to get the maturation to work as quickly as possible.
And finally, John, can you recommend a good whisky that Chemistry World listeners could put on their Christmas list and certainly on their Christmas table this year?
Well, my favourite is the 16-year-old Lagavulin, but that one is maybe an acquired taste. It's very heavily peated, and so there's the wood flavours together with the smoky flavour from the peated malt.
So there you have it, the recommendation of a connoisseur, and what a terrific job he has too, I'm jealous. That was John Piggott, who's at the University of Strathclyde. And now from the world of whisky to the world of proteins, and scientists have made a surprising discovery about how proteins select their metallic sidekicks, or rather don't. Tell us about this, Richard.
Yeah, well, I always imagine that when a protein bound to a metal, it would be really have some really clever chemistry that it would mean it would bind to its manganese or its copper or its zinc, whatever it wanted, and its binding site would choose that or some cofactor would come in.
Are we talking about when certain proteins have a metal attached to them or part of their structure to give them certain chemical behaviours, like hemoglobin has iron? Is that
yeah,
what you
exactly.
mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in fact, about a third of all proteins need the help of a metal to carry out their biological functions, and there's lots of these around. Now, it turns out, according to researchers led by Nigel Robinson at Newcastle University, that it's not as simple as that. And in fact, proteins aren't actually very selective for their metals at all. Now, in some cells, the cells just pump really high concentrations of one metal into the cytoplasm. There's really no option for the protein. It has to bind to that metal. But what Robinson found was that in other cells, such as bacteria, and in particular in the periplasm of bacteria, which is the gap between the heart of the cell, and there's a membrane, and then the very outer edges of the cell, where it's very difficult to control metal concentrations, he wondered, how on earth do all these crucial biological proteins choose, for example, whether they bind to manganese and copper?
So does this mean that theoretically you can end up with lots of dysfunctional proteins that have got the wrong metal jammed into them then?
Well, exactly. That was the puzzle. And he said, well, this protein binds to manganese, but if I put it in a solution of copper and manganese ions of about equal concentration, well, the copper just binds to it much better. And there's no pumping going on. So what is going on?
So how did he solve the problem?
And what he discovered was that the way the different proteins, the manganese binding protein and the copper binding protein, are trafficked out of the cell into different compartments is actually different. And what happens is that the manganese binding protein does its folding in the heart of this bacterial cell before it gets to the outside, whereas the protein that's produced, which needs to bind around copper to do its job, doesn't do that until it gets into the periplasm, where the more strongly binding copper will outcompete anything else. So it's a very sort of neat way of how biology has overcome the limitations of chemistry.
Do we think we could exploit this in some way, perhaps in antibiotics or something like that?
Well, all the researchers have said so far is that, in fact, they're very interested in how proteins will malfunction. So as you said, we could have all sorts of wrong binding proteins. And they reckon that, for example, Alzheimer's, which has already been linked to copper binding proteins, could be caused by copper ions sort of straying off the beaten track. And you can imagine that maybe with the passage of time, copper could accumulate on the wrong proteins or cell trafficking could go wrong. And that could cause them to misfold or fold around other metals.
And that might be why it's difficult sometimes to find certain genes that cause some of these conditions, because it could be other metabolic pathways that should handle those metals and are going wrong. And as a result, the metals are ending up in the wrong bit of the cell, binding onto the protein, then you get a dysfunctional protein, the cell suffers.
Exactly. We should perhaps be looking at cell trafficking routes, compartmentalisation, and there could be a number of diseases linked to metalloproteins, various neurodegenerative disorders, which really could have a boost from this kind of research.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Richard. And it'll be very interesting to see how that research pans out because, of course, the diseases like the neurodegenerative diseases are becoming more common and they're also impossible to treat. All we can do is treat the symptoms. We can't stop them. And it'll be interesting to see what role those kind of chemistries play. Now, Victoria, I'm not really sure whether we can call this chemistry, biology or just germ warfare, but researchers have sussed out how caterpillars fend off ants.
Well, we've decided it's chemistry in the loosest sense of the term, but indeed it turns out that caterpillars and other grazing insects can fend off their predators by spitting a mixture of surfactants and fluids all over them.
What's different than what we thought was going on before?
Well, it was already known that caterpillars and other related insects that graze regurgitate fluids to fend off their predators. But it was believed that these fluids contained toxins from some of the poisonous plants that these grazing insects ate. But it turns out that Michael Rostis of the University of Würzburg and his colleagues decided to look at some of these mixtures to see which toxins were necessary for this sort of this chemical warfare. And it turns out it's not as poisonous as was thought. In actual fact, a toxin-free mixture of this spit can fend off predators very effectively.
What's in it? How does it work?
It contains a mixture of surfactants, which are wetting agents. They reduce the surface tension of a liquid. And it's very clever. The caterpillar is picked up by the predatory ant, and it reacts by vomiting this fluid all over the ant. And because this fluid contains surfactants, instead of rolling off in nice spherical droplets off the ant's back, it soaks the ant through. The surface tension's broken down and it just saturates the ant. So the ant has to drop the caterpillar and start cleaning itself.
Why does it have to do that? Why is it so upset about being made wet?
There's a really lovely picture actually on the Chemistry World website. Basically, the ant is just completely incapable of doing anything because its entire body and its head and its proboscis and everything are just covered in fluid. So its instant reaction is just to drop whatever it's doing, whatever it's attacking or eating, and clean off all of this nasty fluid.
And is the fluid in any other way toxic to the ant? Or is it just this unpleasant stimulus that makes the ant then want to retreat?
Apparently the toxins that are picked up by some of the poisonous plants can form a second line of defence. But what Rostis believes is that this surfactant mixture, just a mixture of peptides, is the first line of defence. And that's the most important mechanism for keeping the caterpillar safe from its predators.
Because, of course, surfactants are the same as washing up liquid. And one wonders whether the role of this is to make the ant's skin more permeable so that some of the toxins that might also be there help to get in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that could be another point. But it seems to be effective in doing what the caterpillar wants to do, which is sort of save its own neck.
I wonder if that surfactant could be used to make a more environmentally friendly detergent for doing dishes. What a pleasant thought. Thank you, Victoria. Well, that's almost it for this month, but there's just time to find out the answer to the chemical conundrum. So, Vic, just summarise, what do we want to know?
So, last month we wanted to know, what is the chemical in wintergreen mints, the US version of Polo mints for our UK listeners, that creates a faint green fluorescent glow as you chew them?
And the answer we wanted, methyl salicylate, also known as oil of wintergreen, which was maybe a bit of a clue. This molecule's fluorescent, which means it absorbs light of a shorter wavelength and then emits it again as light of a longer wavelength. Now, ultraviolet light has a shorter wavelength than visible light, so when a wintergreen lifesaver is crushed between your teeth, the methyl salicylate molecules absorb the ultraviolet shorter wavelength light that's produced by excited nitrogen atoms, and they re-emit it as light of the visible spectrum, specifically as a sort of greeny-blue light. And therefore, you see the blue sparks that jump out of your mouth when you crunch on a wintergreen lifesaver.
And our winners, who will receive Chemistry World goodie bags complete with a packet of wintergreen lifesavers so that they can try that trick at home, are Joanna Tung, Yadhunath Kanmani, Adam Cavalier, Mickey Davis and Gareth Blair.
And now to December's, which is quite a festive question, really. Now, before I tell you what it is, we are offering an extra special prize this month. It's a book reviewed in Chemistry World, Molecules with Silly or Unusual Names. That's a real favourite. It's by Paul May. He also has a website. And basically, it's all those molecules with fantastic names like Halcyone and Fartox and Draculin. Brilliant book. And to win it, answer this month's question. What's the only additive allowed in Scotch malt whiskey apart from water? If you know the answer to that, send us an email with your name and your address and your details so we can contact you. And the email to send it to is chemistryworld@rsc.org.
And John Piggott from the University of Strathclyde, you are not allowed to enter. Thank you, Richard. You can also use that email address that Richard gave you to send in your thoughts or feedback about this or one of our previous Chemistry World podcasts. And please don't forget that we also produce a weekly podcast, which is called Chemistry in Its Element. And that's where we take a look at the sinister side of the periodic table. You can tune in to Chemistry in Its Element on iTunes. And it's also available from the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org/elements. Chemistry World is brought to you this month by Victoria Gill, Richard Van Orden and Matt Wilkinson. The production was by Miracintha Lingam from thenakedscientist.com. And I'm Chris Smith. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.